These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
What is happening, guys? This is something we have been excited about for quite some time on the podcast. In today's episode, we begin a several-part look at labor issues in the NFL. In today's episode, we go deep into 1982 and look at the player strike in 82 and all the issues that existed between management and players. And it's super important, I think, to look at this just on the heels of ratifying the new CBA in the NFL. I think it's going to be an insightful look, especially from Bill's kind of unique perspective as he was a scout in Kansas City and then knowing all the issues that have happened in the last 30 years. But taking a look at this embryonic kind of modern era phase of negotiation between players and management in the NFL. So this one's going to be fun. Buckle in. We're jumping in the DeLorean and we are setting the dial to 82. Let's go. And we are live on the Inside Football Podcast. We are recording on a Monday in the midst of a global pandemic, but life is largely starting to find its routine. I'm happier than I've been in about 2 weeks in my in-laws' house. How are you guys doing today?
I would say I'm less happy that you're in your in-laws' house.
Hey, that works. That's fine. That seems fair.
If you're in your in-laws house and happy, that's good enough for me.
It counts. It's a very reasonable thing. Yeah, no, I feel like I am the son-in-law gold standard of what you need in the midst of a global pandemic apocalypse. But hey, that's all we're talking about. So let's talk about more fun stuff today. Today's episode is going to be a fun one, guys. So we're going to dive deep into the world of the 1982 NFL labor strike. And a little different format we're going to introduce to you guys today that I think is going to work really well in terms of giving everybody a deep understanding of, you know, the topics and everything that was happening around 1982. And sort of in this new format, at the beginning of each episode, we're actually going to introduce a glossary of terms. So a couple terms, really simple, just so that we all have a common syntax. Then we're going to get into like who the main characters are so we can dive really deep on it. And then we'll dive into our story. So I think this is going to be fun for you guys, fun for us. And, you know, as always, if you have feedback or you have any things on the show, you know, hit us up on social media and we will be sure to include it in the show because this is truly an iterative process with you guys. But without any further ado, let's dive into the world of 82. And we're going to start in our glossary today. We got three terms today. And the first one is one that should be familiar to most because we just kind of went through this process in the league. But what is collective bargaining?
So collective bargaining is really described as a sort of a long and very multifaceted written agreement that's negotiated between an employer or a group of employers like the NFL and a union, which represents all the workers that are in play, and the substance is wages, hours, and working conditions. And when you really think of all those, that really controls basically everything that's going on in the workplace.
Cool. And this was in 82, still kind of a relatively new phenomenon in the NFL, as the first collective bargaining agreement wasn't actually, you know, struck until 1968. So we're still kind of in 1982, 14 years into this. And I guess, you know, paired with that is, you know, what is a union and what does that really mean? Because I think a lot of people have a sense of what that means. People are in them. But it would help me in my sort of limited mindset of, if you could just kind of give me the 411 on what an actual union is.
Yeah. So a union is the collective body that represents the workers. The way you go about it is you have to get a percentage of workers at a given job or who work for a particular employer to vote to say that they want to attempt to unionize. Then you have a vote, and if a majority of the employees want to have a union, they do. Once that happens, they are under the aegis of the National Labor Relations Act, which has a lot of protections for people in unions. It has a lot of rules that both sides have to follow. And again, they are the exclusive bargaining agent for everything that has to do with life on that job. Whether you are a longshoreman, you are a steel worker, you know, or you are a deep sea fisherman, if you had a union for those guys.
Okay, cool. And then the final big thing that you'll see kind of bubble up in today's episode, and it's going to be a running theme whenever we do these collective bargaining shows, and I think there's no better person on earth to kind of answer this question than Bill. But what is free agency, and what does it contextually obviously mean in the NFL sense?
Well, in the sports world in general, particularly the big four sports of hockey, football, basketball, and baseball on a professional level, free agency means that a player has completed his contractual obligations to a club with whom he signed a contract, and now he has no further obligation to that club, and he can move to within the guidelines of a collective bargaining agreement, he can move to another club at will. That, and he therefore is a free agent, and as a result, obviously when a guy is free to go on the open market, prices rise effectively and intensely, and as a result, the players have always wanted, one in one form or another, free agency. But as we enter 1982, free agency becomes, if not front and center, certainly the undergirding of everything that the Players Association is talking to the NFL about, and the same is true in all the other big four sports.
And the NFL was kind of a laggard with free agency, right?
Yes, it was. Baseball came effectively in 77 through the ruling of an arbitrator. And it's really a convoluted case, but it ended up an arbitrator declared Andy Messersmith, the pitcher, free of his contract. And as a result, total free agency came to baseball for a brief period of time, but Marvin Miller, the head of the Baseball Players Association, immediately negotiated a completely different system of free agency, which is largely intact today in baseball. Basketball, Oscar Robertson, one of the greatest players of all time, sued for free agency in basketball, and he won in court. And as a result, the NBA entered into a collective bargaining agreement, which gave basketball players effective free agency. The NFL, as you correctly point out, was last to the party.
You know, going back to that baseball example for a second, yeah, you know, you'll recall, Bill, that arbitrator was Peter Seitz, and the other guy who was up, who was sort of the co-plaintiff, so to speak, was Dave McNally of the Baltimore Orioles. But I think Bill made an observation that shows how what a really brilliant guy Marvin Miller was, who is really probably the greatest labor leader in the history of professional sports. Because when the ruling came down, as Bill said, everybody in baseball was going to be free when their contract ran out. And Marvin Miller realized that if everybody's free, then you flood the market and each individual guy's value goes down. So he negotiated something where they staged in free agency and thus turning the supply and demand curve in favor of the players.
Very true. Very true. Well, I don't think we can do a discussion of sort of free agency in the NFL or even sort of the unions want for free agency in the NFL than without a discussion of Ed Garvey, who was the head of the NFLPA during this period in 1982. You know, Rick, I think obviously you're best suited to kind of dive into this at some level, having been at the PA. But who was Ed? Why is Ed important? Why do we need to know about Ed?
Okay, let's start out with some full disclosure. Ed indeed was my boss during my years at the NFLPA, but he was also a good friend who I thoroughly enjoyed spending time with outside the workplace. He was a lifelong progressive activist, starting out in his at his days at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where he was elected president of the student body. Always had a bit of the Paul in him, ran for and won the job as president of a group that was comprised of all the student body presidents at colleges and universities throughout the United States. He moved in political circles that were consistent with his views. He was there for the announcement of the Port Huron Statement, which was a political manifesto that set a template for a more egalitarian society in the United States, including civil rights, workers' rights, and political accountability. Now, the manifesto had been written by Tom Hayden, who some will remember as the leader of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, viewed by some as a radical organization. Others may remember Tom Hayden as Jane Fonda's second husband. In any event, Ed was a brilliant lawyer who first came into contact with the NFLPA in 1970 as its outside counsel, and then the next year he was elected as its executive director. He then moved the operation to Washington, D.C. Ed saw the labor relations in the NFL as part of the greater class struggle between workers and management worldwide. Given that view, Pete Rozelle used to refer to Ed as Madison Red. Ed was very quick-witted. Give you an example. One time he surprisingly got this invitation from the Tampa Bay Rotary Club to be their upcoming after-dinner speaker. Given Ed's perception in the business community, he had never received any kind of an invitation like this before. So he was kind of skeptical. He called us into his office one by one and asked us, did we cook this thing up? Was this, you know, was this for real? When we finally convinced him it was and that he was not being punked, he thought about it and decided he would accept the invitation because, worst case, he was getting a free trip to Tampa Bay where he'd take a meeting with the Bucks and, you know, free dinner. So, you know, how bad could this be? So he goes down there, he meets with the Buccaneers, he goes to the Rotary Club meeting, has the dinner, and gets up and starts speaking. And looks out at the room, seeing all these business types, and says, you know, standing here looking at you all brings me back to the days when I was in Catholic school and the nuns would tell us about Christians being thrown to the lions. And I always wondered what I would do. Would I try and find the weakest lion and fight him? Would I take on the strongest lion, hoping to dissuade the other lions? And I realized what I probably would do
was going to start out by saying, my fellow Hawaiians. So I say to you today, my fellow Rotarians, ours is not an easy task. Anyhow, Ed starts going through the speech and he starts talking about how professional athletes are mistreated and underpaid, all of them, not just football players, but also hockey players and basketball players and baseball players. And when he gets to the baseball part, some guy from the audience yells, bullshit! And Ed goes, rodeo's next. Ed used to say to me, Schaefer, there's nothing wrong with the Jews. They just didn't get the second half of the book. And I would retort by saying, Garvey, you were the most dangerous combination in the world. He'd go, what's that? And I'd say, a Jew with a law degree and an Irishman with a high school diploma.
Right. Coming from the great state of Wisconsin. So on one side of this 82 story, you have Ed Garvey, who's the head of the NFLPA. And then on the other side, you know, from an ownership perspective, you had kind of a two-horse kind of triumvirate, but it was very much led by Hugh Culverhouse, the owner of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Bill, who was Hugh Culverhouse, and what was his sort of significance in this labor dispute in 1982?
Hugh Culverhouse was a lawyer. He was a small town lawyer, effectively, in Alabama. He ended up making some Hollywood connections, and because of his expertise in tax law, became rather prominent in certain sections of the entertainment business. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers were originally scheduled to be owned by another group. The expansion franchise had been granted, and at the last minute, that group didn't have enough money. And the NFL went searching for an owner and found Hugh Culverhouse. And since, as a tax lawyer, he knew lots of loopholes and could see around lots of corners and always drove a hard-ass bargain, he essentially got the franchise for a song. He didn't have to put up all of the money that typically other franchise owners would have to. And he got a great many concessions from the league, not the least of which was that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers would be in the NFC Central Division at that time, which had Minnesota, Detroit, and Green Bay in the division, ensuring, therefore, that when Minnesota, Green Bay, and Detroit, and Chicago came to Tampa Bay to play, hopefully, and Culverhouse engineered this virtually every year, in the winter months, he'd have lots of snowbirds who came down to see their favorite teams play. He needed them because he, from a standpoint of on-field success, he was probably among the worst in the NFL. As far as his views toward union, he viewed them sort of as communistic, un-American, and completely unrealistic operations. And the sooner they're broken and out of his business, the better.
Okay, let me give you a quick sidebar about Hugh Culverhouse. Hugh Culverhouse was also the estate attorney for Cal Rosenblum. Cal Rosenblum had been the owner of the Baltimore Colts and then the Los Angeles Rams. So this could be the time where we could discuss the very suspicious death of Carol Rosenblum and the bizarre memorial service that followed, but we won't. We'll do that in a subsequent show. And that is what's known in the business as a tease, right, Scott?
Right. And sort of complicated in that was his bringing in of, because he was responsible for bringing in kind of our next important character, Jack Donlin, who would be kind of the lead negotiator for the owners through this process, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The owners have a group called the NFL Management Council, who does the statistical and financial work and the arguing the labor negotiations and court cases, if necessary, for the league. And Hugh Culverhouse got himself named as chairman of the NFL Management Council and brought in a management lawyer from Eastern Airlines named Jack Donlin. Rick knows Jack well, and I'll let him take it from there.
But that's pretty amazing in the sense that, you know, Hugh Culverhouse's figure who, you know, wasn't an owner in the NFL, you know, the NFL actually sought him out, comes in, and then literally in 10 years of ownership, because the Bucs came into existence in, what, 72? So in 10 years between now to this time, you know, he's grown in power from an ownership perspective to a level where they've entrusted him to kind of lead this. At the time, that's pretty unprecedented, right?
Yeah, it actually was, because the power in the league, aside from Culverhouse, really rested with what was called the old guard owners. Wellington Mara, whose family owned the Giants since 1925. George Halas, an original founder of the league in 1920. The people like Art Modell in Cleveland, who was the head of the TV committee, which of course at that time was the biggest generator of revenue for the league. Many others who played supporting roles, but Culverhouse, I forgot about Dan Rooney, who we're going to talk about here. The Rooney family had owned the Pittsburgh Steelers since 1933. So that was the principal makeup of the old guard, but Culverhouse had found a way I think because of his legal expertise, had found a way to put himself front and center when it came to dealings with the NFLPA.
Hey, let that be a lesson to everybody. If you know tax law and you maybe worked at the IRS, you can move up no matter in what you do. But hey, that's neither here nor there. But so, you know, to that end, so he brings in Jack Donlin. So who was Jack Donlin, Rick?
Yeah, so Jack Donlin had spent 15 years at National Airlines as their chief negotiator. I found Jack to be a really cynical guy who took his take on labor management relations was he saw it as a game. He saw people as pieces to be manipulated. And he actually really liked to force strikes because he knew that workers, and at the time we're talking about, this is true even of NFL players, were really living paycheck to paycheck. And therefore, if they went on strike and had to hold out for a period of time, taking away the only thing they had in the world, which is their bodies, their services, the economic crunch would get to them and they would return to the bargaining table in a far weakened position from the time they actually went out on strike. And management would have a chance to drive a much harder bargain or even perhaps break the union. And I think that was really Donlin's intent. There was no attitudes that, you know, this is a bigger picture. There's plenty of money to be made. It was, we are in charge. You are the workers. We're going to make you work for the least we possibly can, and we're going to make the most we possibly can.
Well, because back then, was it how it is today, where players predominantly got paid via game checks, or was there the way they were paid different?
No, they were paid predominantly by game checks, and the how often they were paid was a subject of collective bargaining. It changed from CBA to CBA.
Right.
Cool. So we'll get into that more in a second. But then finally, our fourth kind of key character in today's show in the 82 strike, and sort of interesting because he'll play sort of an ambassador role as we get to the end of this story, but would be Dan Rooney, owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, who Bill, you knew really well. So who was Mr. Rooney, Ambassador Rooney, and what was his significance in the league then? And then obviously I think many fans know kind of his importance moving forward.
Well, Dan Rooney was the son of Art Rooney Sr., the founder of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Art Rooney Sr. was a Pittsburgh native who was essentially a sports promoter. He had been quite a good semi-pro football and baseball player and a boxer. He owned, among other things, racehorses, restaurants, essentially bars. But he was principally a sports promoter. He came into the NFL when it was a franchise were available for a song. in the late 20s, at the heart of the Depression, and into the 30s, kept the Steelers afloat during World War II by combining in 1943 with the Philadelphia Eagles and in 1944 with the Chicago Cardinals. But more importantly, Mr. Rooney was a beloved figure in the league and basically a friend to everyone. He was, of course, a beloved figure all his life in Pittsburgh because of his charitable nature and his kindliness toward everyone. But he couldn't manage to field a winning football team. The Steelers were also Rans virtually for all the time that Mr. Rooney owned them. But he put Dan in charge, and Dan hired Chuck Knoll. They had 2-2-14 seasons. And then toward the late 70s and through this time in the 80s, the Steelers became, largely because of the Steel Curtain defense, but because of other great players like Terry Bradshaw and Franco Harris as well, the marquee team in pro football. But rather than act like the big dog after being the little dog for so long, Dan Rooney was just the opposite. He was exactly like his father, a very charitable, very honorable man with great integrity, tremendously funny, tremendously friendly, and a person who everyone gravitated to. In addition, he was extremely level-headed and a very, very good businessman. So he was in a position where he was sort of the anti-Jack Donlin on the management council. He was well aware of the players and their concerns. His family had shared them for a long period of time. And from this time forward, actually from 1977 forward, until he left to become ambassador to Ireland during the Obama administration, he was the enduring power in the league, trusted by everyone, players union, management people, employees, and the Pittsburgh Steelers were not only the flagship franchise, but the model franchise based in a city that loved them with an owner and players and coaches who loved that city back.
Well, I'm going to throw a little bit of an audible at you, Bill, because there had to have been, you know, and we'll obviously know this as we go through and kind of get into 82 in detail. But, you know, when Ambassador Rooney kind of left, there had to have been a huge gap in sort of ownership in the league. Who has really stepped in to kind of fill that Dan Rooney role today?
John Mara of the New York Giants, scion, of course, of Tim Mara, actually grandson of Tim Mara, the original founder, and son of Wellington Mara, who, along with Dan Rooney, was also a beloved figure and revered figure in the league. It's interesting that all the years that I was a general manager and club president, and therefore present at virtually every league meeting, except that was a meeting that was held only for owners. You're normally allowed two per club, so I was the second guy for about 18 of those years. When there was a very difficult issue on the table and debates were hot and heavy, usually the last person to speak by design was Wellington Mara. He and the owner of the Jets, Leonard, I can't think of his last name. Leon Hess, excuse me, Leon Hess, were usually the guys that had the last word, and they were usually representing what was the sort of consensus of the old guard of the league. Dan would rarely speak when Mr. Hess was alive. Once Mr. Hess passed on and the Jets were sold, Dan became more forward in the league meetings. Prior to that, he'd been the conciliator behind the scenes, which, of course, his father had played the same role in the early years of the league. But as time went on and Wellington got a little older and then passed away, Dan was the sort of the representative of the old line families who had started the National Football League.
I can tell you that from the Players Association standpoint, Dan and Wellington were basically irreplaceable. There was a deep feeling that they had a sense of fairness to the players, that they cared about their players as human beings. And in fact, they were the owners, members of something called the PCRC, the Player Club Relations Committee, which was a step before arbitration where we tried to mediate disputes between clubs and players. And as long as the two of them were the owners' representatives, the union responded in kind, and you had to get three of the four votes in order to avoid arbitration. So that meant that one owner had representative had a crossover, or a union had a crossover. And because those two gentlemen were so fair, there was a lot of crossing over, and a lot of things got resolved at the mediation at the PCRC level, rather than having to take them to arbitration. As soon as they were replaced by various people, the whole thing broke down, and PCRC became nothing other than sort of a phantom stop along the way to arbitration. So you can't really overemphasize the role they played. And while I'm at this, I have to say that later I became very, very close with Leon Hess, and he was just a wonderful man. And a great man, and also was a guy who really cared about his players deeply.
I mentioned earlier that John Mara is now a key player in labor relations, and he is. He's joined by Robert Kraft of the New England Patriots, who was largely responsible, along with Jeff Saturday, one of my former players in Indianapolis, for settling the lockout in 2011. So it's really John Mara, who has a long run left in him in the league, and Robert Kraft, who basically are the standard bearers for the management council these days.
Very cool. Well, one more piece of the puzzle that we need to put together, and you know, for our purposes, probably the most important piece of the puzzle. Where were you in 1982 in your football life, Bill?
I was a advanced scout. Pro scout for the Kansas City Chiefs, toiling in the trenches, learning my trade. There weren't many advanced scouts in those days. Kirk Mee of the Washington Redskins was a good friend that came to mind. Later on, Abe Gibron, with the a great former player and coach with the Seattle Seahawks. But I was out there beating the bushes for talent. Filing scouting reports on the upcoming opponents and basically learning about the National Football League from my boss in Kansas City, both Marv Levy, the head coach, and Jim Schaaf, the general manager, who was very, very instrumental in teaching me how the league worked and what management was all about.
But so in being an advanced scout, did you have a sense that this labor discourse was coming? How would that impact your sort of life and career?
Oh, yeah, definitely. When you're an advanced scout, you're at the game of the upcoming opponent every week. And part of your preparation is to read everything that's written about that team in those days in the newspapers and to listen to some of what was spoken about on television and radio. But principally, print was the way you learned about it. And then in the press box on Sunday, where the advanced scouts are seated, I'd often run across some of the top columnists around the country who covered the NFL, and they would ask questions of me about our team. I'd try to be tell them as little as I could, but they would often answer questions that I would ask about the landscape of the league, how things were going, what was happening, and so I learned a lot because if not at the center of the storm, I was at least in the periphery. And not removed from it.
Because it's a really interesting view, because just to set the stage, I mean, you know, a lot of us forget that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, the league was in a very different place than it is today in terms of from a television property. I mean, the league, you know, obviously very different TV time, but the league was the 10th, you know, had the 10th rated television show on television behind things like 60 Minutes, Dallas. Maybe 60 Minutes should be rated number one again. Who knows? But, you know, just my thought. And league revenue at the time from a TV standpoint was kind of in that 450 to 490, about 470 million range. And then you had kind of a legitimate burgeoning spring league threat coming with the USFL. I mean, what did the league look like, you know, as we head into kind of what's going to be a big labor dispute heading into the second week of the season?
Well, the labor dispute is a precursor to what it was a thunderstorm, which became a hurricane when the USFL came on board. The players, and Rick will go into the demands that they made, but the players had some very specific and unique demands, which the owners were unwilling to embrace. And on the horizon was a spring league, the USFL, that was going to play in major league cities. And no one quite knew what approach the USFL was going to take toward talent acquisition. But they, throughout the history of professional football, going all the way back to the original founding of the NFL in 1920, the advent of another league was the only thing that drove players' salaries up. The AAFC after World War II, and now the USFL, they clearly knew, did the owners, that players' salaries were going to be on the rise with this new league. They didn't know how high, they didn't know how the league was going to approach it, but they were going up. There was no question about that. So this collective bargaining agreement and strike is a really bad thunderstorm, but there was a hurricane on the horizon.
Because was the fear fact, so, I mean, just to set the stage, there's no, because in 1982, there's no salary cap, right? There were minimums in terms of what you could spend on players. I think, you know, $20,000 to $32,000 for 4 years in experience and then, you know, those kinds of things. But there wasn't a cap. There was this kind of minor floor. How did that affect your guys' thought process, decision-making, even on the scouting level in terms of, like, did you have a sense that big-name players, you know, that would eventually play in the that you were going to lose out on them and the league was going to lose out on them because of maybe an unwillingness to spend or, on the USFL side, a willingness to spend astronomical amounts of money at the time to bring players in?
Well, there might have been, but Donlan did his best to tamp down any idea that there ought to be concessions made to the union because the USFL was on the horizon. Donlan was a warrior. He was a hawk. And therefore, his idea is pay the players as little as possible, give them as little as possible in benefits, and that's a victory for us, and we'll worry about the USFL when it comes along. So that was the prevailing ethos as they went into the 82 collective bargaining, situation.
You know, and Scott, you have to remember that though there was no cap, there was also no effective free agency. Nobody moved. Though they theoretically had the right to move at the end of their contractual obligation, as Bill earlier explained, there was basically a tacit understanding you didn't sign another guy's player. So the only way, as Bill mentioned, salaries ever spiked was when there was a competitor for those players, because there was not competition within the league, and therefore salaries stagnate.
This was actually a curveball that Garvey threw at the league, which at the time was viewed as not a curveball, but an atomic bomb, an unlivable situation by the owners. But what it did was stave off the players' focus on free agency. their focus went away from free agency, which had been a big pre-82 focus, and went to Garvey's demand of 55% of the gross. So free agency went on the back burner in 82 as Garvey put forth this, quote, communistic, close quote, approach that Culverhouse and Donlan couldn't wait to use as a pinata and just take as big a baseball bats as they could and hammer away on the fact that this communistic union leader was bringing communism to the NFL and therefore would cause the NFL's demise.
You know, which is kind of ironic, given the fact that the NFL owners had organized, I won't use the word communistic, but they had certainly organized the most successful socialistic enterprise in probably in the history of the world, right? I mean, maybe you can tell everybody about, you know, the way revenue sharing worked and so on. I mean, it was completely socialistic.
Well, to start off with, Garvey recognized that revenue sharing was a staple of stability in the league. Revenue was shared among the owners. And this goes back to the late 1930s when television came to the fore. The Chicago Bears, the Cleveland Browns, the New York Giants had television networks of their own that they owned and circulated around various markets close to within 75 miles of their home territory. And it became very lucrative. And then along about 1955, the league began to think about whether or not they ought to sell their rights, television rights as a whole, as an entire unit, rather than to allow these three behemoths to continue to grow and prosper and the others fall by the wayside. And Pete Rozelle, the then commissioner, was able to convince them, and to convince Congress, by the way, because this was against the law, to allow them to pool their resources and sell their rights as a league, not as individuals, but as a league to a network or networks. So they originally sold the rights to the NFL in the early 1960s to CBS, and CBS paid a rights fee, which was divvied up in those days 12 ways. Everybody got the same, even though the Giants and the Bears had by and the Rams by far had the largest television markets. So that revenue sharing was a staple of the NFL from that time forward, and it allowed the NFL to grow and prosper because it created competitive balance. Everybody had the same amount of television money to spend, and they spent it basically on players. And so if you tracked spending, even to this day, actually, player spending almost until 1993 tracked directly with team television revenue. So if television revenue in a given year was $50 million per team, that's what they spent on salaries. There was no governor on salaries. There was nothing that prevented them from paying more. Many, like Culverhouse, paid less. But generally speaking, television money funded player salaries because that was all shared revenue. And then gate receipts, tickets, parking, concessions. And later on, as we enter the 1989 period, luxury boxes began to bring revenue into owners' pockets that previously did not exist. Ticket sales were a negligible, were a source of revenue, but were quickly passed by television revenue. So for Garvey to come in and say, I want 55% of the gross revenues, whatever that was, he didn't really know what it was, the owner said, no, we're not giving you a percentage of the gross. Your workers, we're the owners. At the same time, they were sharing 100% of the television revenue among them.
You know, and when you think about that, a couple of things. Number one, you know, sports is really the most labor-intensive, enterprise there is, because when you think about costs other than players, I mean, they're relatively de minimis. So if you have one funding source that's going to pay the cost of all your labor, and you're right, the other monies weren't as high as they are, you know, in the newer era, but all the other monies, you know, just could basically go into the pockets of the owners. And Garvey, the other thing about his philosophy was, and why he sort of backed off free agency at this point in time and went for the 55% idea, was he felt that the guys who could really generate bids in free agency, which were the stars, were already making enough money and could take care of themselves. And what he was trying to do was to assure that the average player or the players on the bottom of the salary spectrum were going to be taken care of, and they needed the union to do that because they didn't have the power to do that individually. They were just chattel. They were fungible, and they needed something like what he had in mind to get them what Ed believed to be each player's fair share of a very successful enterprise, even at that point in time.
But I think this is where we, even as fans today, get confused. So, all right, so let's take two steps back. So in terms of revenue, in terms of pooled revenue, the owners share television revenue, but with the gate receipts, merchandising, that other revenue, does that go into the pool, or is that something that the individual teams just keep for themselves?
In those days, the individual teams kept it for themselves. And Garvey, essentially, I think Rick knows more about this from the union side than I, but Garvey was essentially asking for a piece of that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and as time would go along, as NFL properties was built out, and there were other sources of income, there was pooling of that as well. And Bill, what I'm trying to recall, the gate receipts split between the home team and the visiting team at that point in time. Can you remember?
Yeah, that goes back to the 1930s. When only the Giants and the Bears drew big, and the Washington Redskins drew big crowds, the owners, the have-not owners, if you will, those that didn't draw big crowds, wanted a significant portion of the gate receipts. So, 37% of the gate receipts for a home game went to the visiting team, and that was true until we hit. Somewhere in the 2000s, where so-called ancillary revenue had blossomed so much that they took all of the visiting team revenue and put it in a pool, and everybody shared 1/32nd of that, which made it even more equitable among the owners.
Right, and I'll tell you, in my career, when people would ask me whether it was players I was going to represent or civilians asked me about this. I tried to explain it to them. I would say to them, what percentage of the money from the Super Bowl do you think the winning team gets? I'm not talking about the players' bonuses, the actual owner of the winning team. What percentage of the money do they get? And they go, some people would say 50%, some people would say 70%. And I would say to them, they get one, and this type of point in time, there are 32 teams, they get 1/32nd of the money from the Super Bowl. And the team that wins one game or no games, they also get 1/32nd of this, of the money from the Super Bowl. And people were astounded and sort of appalled at this. And, you know, it was only when you tried to get them to understand that you could really begin for them to appreciate the dynamics that were at play in this labor management balance.
So when Garvey's asking for like 55% of the total revenue, what would that go to on the player side? So would that account for again, because I even think in the modern context, people get confused about this when they hear about the new CBA where players are getting, I think, between 47% or 48.5%, depending on how many games there are. But, you know, does that go to player salary, or is that allotted in somewhere in the cap, or is this money that's outside of kind of current player money? And this goes to things like pension, you know, healthcare benefits, those kinds of things. How does that work?
The gross number that you hear, 47 to 48.5%, it takes into account every dollar that is earmarked for players. And then there are subsets of that. Players' salaries, bonuses, etc., come out of that. That's the cap. The cap caps spending for player salaries. Then over and above that, there are expenditures for, which are collectively bargained, for pension, for health benefits, for retirement benefits for previous retirees, for 401k, there's an additional 401k plan, for severance. All of those so-called benefit costs are included in that number that the players receive, and then it's broken down through a very strict accounting process that's agreed to on an ongoing basis, on a daily basis, by the Players Association representatives and Management Council's representatives.
Yeah. Now, at that point in time that we're talking about, some of those categories didn't even exist. And, of course, at the union, we were trying to figure out what 55% of the gross really meant, because you try to figure out what each club was making. And the only way to do that was to look at the numbers from the Green Bay Packers, because they were the only publicly disclosed team, because they were owned by the city of Green Bay and were a public entity. So there was a lot of extrapolation and guessing going on as to what 55% of the gross really meant. But I can tell you that in Ed's mind, he did not think that players were being apportioned anything close to 55% of the gross at that point in time.
And was there ever any pushback from owners? So, like, because, I mean, I know this from, like, sort of the film business, because this feels very much like print and advertising, right? So, like, you know, in my life in the movies, when we deliver a movie to the studio, obviously our revenue share on gross receipts from the movie kicks in after what's called P&A, so print and advertising, which is insane today because it's not like you make prints of the movies or just distributed digitally. But, like, you know, what's crazy is, and maybe I think maybe even from a PA perspective, they did a bad job of kind of marketing this even to fans, because I don't think fans even today really get this, that, like, that's just gross. It's not sort of cut after expenses, but the players have a hard time. I mean, even today, don't the players probably have a hard time figuring out what that exact number is, or is that fully transparent? How does that accounting side work?
No, it's totally transparent. The union gives it to the player reps, who in turn will answer questions from the players. But the rank and file players don't pay much attention to the pension plan. They pay a little more attention to severance. They want to know what's in my paycheck 17 times a year. That's
right.
All they want.
That's about it. That's all any of us care about.
It's only when they become retired players that they take far more active interest in their pension plan.
Right.
And I think, in terms of what you're asking, yeah, the numbers are now disclosed. I mean, that was also, you know, again, not the case then. And I think the film industry, Scott, is a lot less transparent in terms of, Forrest Gump has still not made money. So.
Yeah, no, but I mean, you'd have to think at the time you would have owners who at some level were probably crying poor and saying, because, I mean, even in doing like the research for this episode, you know, looking at sort of like the Buccaneer spending, for example, like with Hugh Culverhouse, you know, they were, you know, purported in to players to be around fifth, I think, in the league in terms of spending money on players, and then famously underpaid Doug Williams and some other stuff. But then, as it turned out, once you actually got the reasonable data, they were closer to 20. 21st. So I think even at this time in the league, it was a huge undertaking for the players to get this data, understand what this data meant. And it was truly kind of a transformational argument for Garver to even be asking this.
It was. And the thing it did was distract both the players and management away from the free agency argument, which had been the linchpin of everything that preceded this 1982 strike and would again be the linchpin that almost brought the league to its knees in the not too distant future.
So, I mean, did this come as just a total surprise to just from a negotiation standpoint, was this, because Rick, you probably know this as well as anybody, was this just a total surprise to the ownership and to Donlin in particular, that this was going to be, shake our fist, big public demand, that wasn't going to be free agency, that it was going to be, we want this revenue split? Did this throw the owners off at any, did this give leverage to the players early in this process?
Well, obviously I don't know exactly what the owners knew, but I mean, think about it, how many players there are in the league. They're closely covered by the press. People talk. So it was not like this was, completely out of the blue. I mean, there had been discussion leading into this collective bargaining agreement, among all the players on all the teams and union officials. So I would imagine, Bill, they sort of knew something was coming. But I think the point, really, the major point is what Bill was referring to before. At this point, Ed and Ed really ran this thing from the top down, because as Bill said, most players are just worrying about making the team, getting playing time, staying healthy when they get injured. Then you have a rep from each club. So let's say even when it's at 32, you have 32 guys. Then those guys select the board or seven guys, and Ed needed a majority of and the reps would do whatever the board said. The players would do whatever the reps said. So if Ed could control four guys, which is the majority of the board, he controlled the entire union. And that's why he was did things like become the union for all the soccer players, a lot of other ideas, that he advanced that were sort of much more far afield than anything the players would have had in mind. So at this point, he had just decided that the mechanism of free agency, even if you got it to the players, wasn't going to work. It wasn't going to get most guys paid sufficiently. So he gave it up and he went for the 55% of the gross. And as Bill said, therefore it wasn't lost on Ed that he was abandoning free agency. He was abandoning free agency because he felt free agency would never yield the players the fair share. So instead, eliminate the middleman and go right after the fair share.
Don't forget the union's rallying cry prior to this had been no football, no freedom, no football.
Right.
And now they were asking for 55% of the gross. From a public relations standpoint, no freedom, no football was not something that the general public basically rejected. I mean, there was a feeling of, that might be fair. It was a harder argument for the NFL to defeat. 55% of the gross portrayed as a communist plot in 1982 was, said earlier, an easy pinata for Donlin to take a baseball bat to.
Yeah, that dog didn't hunt.
You're right, Bill. But what's funny? Over the years, when I'd have discussions with people and talk about the idea of free agency, the average person would sort of look at this as like some extraordinary thing that players were asking for, when the fact is that everybody but those players is a free agent. I mean, if you work at a law firm and you don't want to work there anymore, you go to another law firm. You work for a grocery store, you don't want to work there, you go to another grocery store. Everybody else in the world is a free agent, at least in Western democracies. And the players are the only trying to get the same right to move that way that all the other citizens in the country had. And so I always found it ironic that this was looked at as sort of some special, kind of treatment they were looking for because they were wonderful athletes, whereas really they're just asking for the same to be treated the way everybody else was. And therefore, it is a lot easier to understand that, you know, that, that if you, you won't let me, if you won't let me be a free guy to move if I want to move, you know, I'm not going to play for you. I'm going to withhold the only thing I have, which is my body and my services. So, and I agree that 55% of the gross with the owners controlling the media to a great extent was really something that was going to be hard to sell to fans and who already thought players made too much money and were being greedy.
So Bill, in terms of how this impacted your life, so the strike would actually start kind of in light of this demand, you know, both sides are entrenched, and the strike would start on September 21st, 1982, following a Monday Night Football game at the old Giant Stadium. So right at the end of week two. So what happens, like, even in your life as an advanced scout, from like the mechanics of the strike? Obviously the players are gone, but what happens in your life? Does life sort of go on as normal? Do you start focusing on other stuff?
Well, the personnel department focused on college scouting. College season was still going, so we turned our efforts in that regard, feeling that these things always end, and at some point there would be an end and we'd get back to business, which is what we did. It ended badly for us in Kansas City. For us, I mean Marv Levy and his staff, of which I was a member, because there was so much bad blood. The strike ended with not even a hint of 55% of the gross. They got increased minimums. They got increased pension and benefits, but nothing much more. And they lost really all the money that they'd lost when they were not playing. It didn't come back in a lump sum or something like that. So the players were very bitter about it, bitter toward management, and they were divided among themselves in the sense that the higher paid players felt, well, okay, we tried. The lower paid players, who were maybe going to lose their jobs and certainly lost a great deal of money, were terribly bitter toward management about it. So we had a split locker room. And when we came back, a very promising team that had gone 9-7 and barely missed the playoffs the year before in the third year or fourth year of a rebuilding mode, now collapsed. And even though the last two or three games of the season we played more than well enough to win and actually beat the New York Jets, who were the Eastern Division champions on the last game of the season, Mr. Hunt decided to make a change in Kansas City, and Marv Levy and everybody else with him was fired.
Right.
It was interesting that experience clearly drove the way we approached the strike of 87. And it was radical, and it got us in trouble with both Marv Levy and I, of course, were in Buffalo at the time. Mr. Wilson, our owner, supported us. Donlin just despised us, and probably me more than anybody. But it proved to be the linchpin for our success in Buffalo. So when they say one door closes, another opens. The bitter experience of the strike of 82 in Kansas City led us to ultimately four straight Super Bowls in Buffalo.
Right. I mean, I guess to that point, kind of. Do you know that? In the process of doing this, like, because obviously everybody knew that there was bad blood, two entrenched sides, the strike would go for 57 days. I mean, were there any options in 82 or discussions around replacement players or staging? I mean, I know the players themselves famously staged two All-Star games where, DC legend John Riggins famously is quoted as saying he would do anything for money when only 8,000 people showed up for the DC game. But, I mean, was there any talk from ownership at that point in 82, because it obviously would be a big deal in 87, about replacement players or just different options for what to do?
Well, I was not in the league meetings at that time, so I can't speak to it personally, but I didn't hear anything about it. And once the players staged the All-Star games and they were such abject failures, I don't think anybody on the ownership side had any desire to stage replacement games because they could see that the union was crumbling, their position was crumbling, and ultimately the strike was going to get settled on their terms, on management's terms, before too long.
You know, Donlan's strategy was a harsh strategy, but he was right. He basically brought the union back on their knees.
So I guess to that point, I mean, the one sort of kind of interesting thing in 82 that we haven't kind of touched on is, you know, when you have a strike like this, what happens, you know, from a TV deal standpoint? So, because I think this is obviously, you know, living in the coronavirus world, everybody's kind of interested about this now. But, you know, how does that work with the league's deals with TV, you know, in that time or even now, just in terms of if the league can't stage games on television, are there givebacks or clawbacks that the network have? How does that work?
Yeah, there are clawbacks in every network contract. Now, depending on the circumstances, they're subject to negotiation. Typically, it's numbers of games televised. And so if you have a shortened season, you will hear talk, and you heard talk in the past and actually saw actions in the past where the playoffs were expanded, which gave the networks extra games and extra games at a time when everybody was watching television, and games that, quote, counted, close quote, toward the championship. And so that's typically how it works. The networks in the NFL are partners, and while one pays the other money, in all but one case that I can remember, the NFL has always wanted to keep the networks happy and vice versa.
Right. So, I mean, I think everyone famously will remember in the 82 season, it would actually end with an expanded playoff format where you'd have 16 of the 28 teams compete in the playoffs. So that probably was born out of some negotiation between ownership and the networks. Because one thing, just from a kind of dumb fan's perspective, at least that I was thinking of, is if there were clawbacks in these TV deals, you wonder if it's at some level a benefit of the players to hold out even longer just to see at what point, you know, in this phase the owners would break. But I guess, you know, players, because they were on a check-to-check basis, just didn't have the liquidity or the ability to do that at this time.
You are absolutely right, and that's true even today.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole Donlan theory, that management will ultimately always have the deep pockets and the players cannot withstand the pressure.
I think that's the scary foreshadowing of what a potential labor stoppage would look like in the future NFL, maybe 20, 30 years from now, of, as you know, players begin to make more money, have other ancillary revenue streams outside of football. And, you know, as we learn the sort of potentially navigating these uncharted TV waters, it'll be interesting to see what kind of leverage the players have moving forward in these kinds of deals. Because it'll be, I think the pendulum may change at some point one day.
I think you're right, but a lot of it's going to depend on what the media landscape looks like going forward. And one of the most compelling reasons that both sides agreed to this new collective bargaining agreement is that neither can predict what the media landscape is going to look like going forward. So they entered into a 10-year deal, which guarantees labor peace for 10 years and therefore maximum flexibility for the league and its players to take advantage of whatever changes take place in the media landscape. That proved to be a prescient approach to things because now with the pandemic, the world has changed dramatically, and the future of full stadiums, mass gatherings, that kind of thing, from a legal perspective and a practical perspective, is really in doubt. Zeke Emanuel, who is a renowned physician and a guy who spends a lot of his time thinking about the future and how things, how disease and disease control affects the future, said unequivocally over the weekend that he doesn't see any mass gatherings until 2021.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that that his brothers, are Ari Emanuel, who's the real Ari Gold, and Rahm Emanuel, who is the mayor of Chicago. So they're a very underachieving family. So I don't know why anybody would really want to listen to what they have to say.
But I think to that end, Bill, I mean, you know, as we, I'm going to pull a little bit of an audible here on this one, just because I think it's pertinent. There are some really strange parallels, if you think about it, you know, between 82 and sort of where we are from a modern standpoint. You know, as we enter, you know, 40 years later, there's going to be a new TV deal in 2022. Obviously, the pandemic is going to change some of how that works. And you would have to assume at some level the owners wish that the players hadn't agreed to this current deal. But what do you see the future of television in the NFL looking like? From a TV property standpoint, do you think the rights will move to streaming services? What is your sense of where we'll be, you know, in 2 or 3 years as these negotiations take place?
Well, I often said when people ask me who might win a football game my team was involved in, I don't bet, and if I did, I'd go broke. So I'm not a very good prognosticator. I deal with the things that I know. One thing I know is, and I'm echoing Paul Tagliabue here, our game, which is played in a rectangle, fits very well into the rectangular television screen. Our game is played and reaches its zenith in the winter months when much of the country is indoors and watching television. Our game has a tremendous following because of our liberal TV policy, where effectively every game is televised in some form or another into the market of every team. That much we know. And we know that in a landscape now with 500 television stations and therefore a fragmented market, so market share is completely destroyed from what it was in the early days of television, or even in the heyday of television in the 70s and 80s. The only thing that draws consistent, huge ratings and consistent, huge audiences is football, and NFL football draws biggest of all. So ours will be, as I say, NFL is a hot property. The question of who will pay to televise or disseminate that hot property in what form is very much open. For example, up until today, we presumed that ABC and ESPN would make a joint bid for Sunday Night Football and potentially Monday Night Football together. Well, guess what? Disney Company's theme parks are closed and will be for a long period of time. Their cruise business may never come back. The world has changed. So the short answer is stay tuned.
Yeah, because you wonder if this is the moment. This is the moment where the NFL builds, you know, this is totally kind of going to be a out there idea. But do you know if there's ever been discussion about the NFL building their own over the top, like OTT network, where they just distribute programming directly themselves? And then there's some sort of, you know, annual direct subscription fee kind of modeling that they would do?
Of course, that's the NFL network. And that's why the NFL right. Network was originally built out. And now there are legal implications there, but the NFL has the best legal minds in the country, both in and out of their offices. So there's no reason to believe that they haven't been working on that part of it for a long time, including streaming. So if it's the NFL's in perfect position to do that. In fact, in better position than most other professional sports.
Bill, I am in total accord with your take there. My only caveat would be that when you go back to the original antitrust exemption the league received from Congress, there was a built-in obligation to deliver games free of direct charge to consumers. So, and that, of course, all there was broadcast television in those days. Now that we have these other mechanisms, whether it is streaming or the NFL Network itself, my guess would be while some games could come that way, the requirement of the antitrust exemption would still be there to say that the majority of the games are going to have to be delivered, however they're done, but they have to be delivered free of direct charge to the viewer.
Well, you can always, you can even if you're the NFL Network, you can always provide free television. It's fairly easy to do. The question is, who would carry it, under what rights fee setup, etc. That's pretty, complying with the law is pretty easy to do. The landscape of who the disseminators are going to be remains to be seen. I think that's an open question. And the point that Disney Company is today a very different company going forward than it was just 48 hours ago is, or even 2 weeks ago, is just proof of that.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And then I guess the other thing that would sort of be born out of this, just from a strict Audible standpoint, is in light of the USFL and sort of its birth right around the time of the 82 strike, you know, this week we saw the demise of the XFL. Do you think this is probably, I mean, obviously, you know, coronavirus and COVID is going to affect this moving forward, but we're probably entering a lull dark period, don't you think, for another competitive spring league, unless the NFL became their own broadcast partner and saw the necessity of it?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. The XFL, by the way, I heard was going to declare bankruptcy today or sometime in the near future, which, whether that's a good or bad financial move for the people that work there remains to be seen. But its demise was assured when the NFL expanded its practice squad and regular season squad numbers essentially by 5 per team in this new collective bargaining agreement. That's 160 jobs, and that's too few players. It leaves too few players for any spring league to function efficiently in, and obviously the people at the XFL saw that as well as we can. In addition, the idea of mass gatherings being the last thing to come on board is also a consideration, because their product would not be a very marketable product on television as a standalone. So, bottom line, I think we've seen the last of the spring leagues, at least for the until some new normal settles in, and this is a 10-year CBA. It's unlikely that someone's with two spring leagues, by the way, well-run football operations, self-serving in one sense saying that, but so was the XFL. The bottom line is that they couldn't make money, and why are you going to be in business if you can't make money?
Yeah, no. And then this is a last personal request for me as we wrap up the 82 episode in light of all that's happening with coronavirus. I don't know if you guys saw it this week. Did you see in the Chinese baseball leagues that they've got robots in the stands being like fake fans at their baseball games?
I did. Both of you guys know more about how to do filming than I. But aren't some sports movies shot with cardboard extras in the stands?
Yeah, which you can do, but this is a plea. This is more an end of podcast plea. Bill, if there's anybody you can talk to at the league that just avoids, like, God forbid we can't be in the stands next season, and we do, we're lucky enough to get a season. If there's any way we can avoid having horrifying robot animatronic things in the stands, we got to get that word out, because it's creepy, it's scary, and I think it just makes everything worse. And oh, by the way, why do they have all these robots who they can just wheel out and now have fans at sporting events in like 10 minutes?
It's the rise of the machine.
We got to get the word out. So I don't know who we have to talk to, but if we can't do it, if you're listening to the podcast, please try to get the word out. We do not need robots at FedEx Field or any other NFL venue next fall. Well, with that, that's today's show. Hopefully you like it. If you have questions or anything you want to talk about on the show, please remember to hit us up on social media. We'll try to get to your questions and answer them on a future episode. And again, thank you for the time today, guys, and stay safe.
Stay safe, everybody. That's the watchword of the day.
Amen. Stay safe, and our condolences and good wishes to everyone who suffered with this terrible pandemic.
Very true. Well, thank you, guys. Hopefully you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.